And good morning. It's 8:06 on KPCW's Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. And if I'm reading it correctly, it's 0 degrees here in Old Town Park City, -2 in Heber. On the phone with more about weather in the Wasatch back this morning, it's APC4's meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, we've got some very cold, frigid temperatures out there with those single digits and teens across most of the region. And as we go throughout the rest of the day, we are going to warm it up, but it's going to stay below average with high temperatures both in Park City and Heber climbing only to around the freezing mark. So it's not going to get much warmer than above freezing across most of the area here as we go throughout the day. Again, lots of sunshine, and there could be a little bit of haze trying to sneak into some of the valley areas there around the Heber Valley area. Probably should stay out of the Park City area for the most part. As we go into tonight, it's another frigid night with mostly clear skies and light winds. We'll see our overnight lows back down into the single digits in the Heber Valley and lows right around 9, 10 degrees again for Park City as well. So, yes, just frigid conditions continuing out there with more sunshine as we go throughout the day on Wednesday afternoon. Highs will be climbing into the mid-30s across the area, so it is going to be still at or slightly below average again as we go into your Wednesday afternoon. And we'll continue to trend into your Thursday with that hazy sunshine and highs in the mid to upper 30s with overnight lows in the single digits and the teens. We start to see some changes by the time we get towards your Friday, though. We'll start to introduce a few more clouds with a southerly wind kicking in, and that should bump our temperatures up a little bit more. After starting off in the teens for lows, we'll see our highs getting into the low to mid 40s across the area. So that will be a nice change considering where we have been the past few days and will be for the next couple of days ahead. So we start to warm it up as we head into the weekend, and then we introduce a chance of some rain and snow showers as we get into your Friday night, and that will persist into your Saturday as well. Saturday morning, we'll start off with those temperatures down into the mid to upper 20s across the area, and we'll see a better chance of those rain and snow showers continuing into the afternoon hours with highs on Saturday into the low to mid 40s. So we start to climb a good bit above freezing, and that means as we get into your Sunday, we're going to be talking about probably more rain showers as opposed to snow showers in both the Heber Valley and in Park City with highs in the mid to upper 40s and overnight lows at or slightly above freezing. And then by the time we kick off next week, we're talking about some real warm weather moving our way with high temperatures back close to the 50-degree mark for both Park City and the Heber Valley, with overnight low temperatures only dropping down into the low to mid 30s. So we've got a couple of more frigid mornings and frigid nights ahead for us, but we start a warming trend Friday into the weekend. Along with that, a chance of a few rain and snow showers. But the bigger story will be the potential much warmer weather that will start to surge into the area as we get towards the beginning of next week. So if you've got some tea times you've been planning, looks like next week will be the time to make that happen.
All right. We'll bundle up in the meantime. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And with a look at Utah's backcountry on the phone from the Utah Avalanche Center, I believe we've got forecaster Nikki Champion.
Morning. So yesterday was a generally quiet day in the backcountry. No new reports of avalanches occurring yesterday. A few more trickled in that happened on the 26th. Observers did note that the snow surface is becoming really weak. So the only type of avalanches we're seeing are some loose facet sloughs, or we call them facet avalanches sometimes, just when the snow surface picks up some traction and moves itself. Right now we've got two main issues. The first is just going to be that wind drifted snow. So we're dealing with both new slabs that could be forming today with the easterly winds, as well as some widespread hard slab avalanches from last week's really elevated winds. The hard slabs are sitting on top of a small layer of faceted grains, so they're going to be more sensitive and a little bit more dangerous. As well, we're still talking about that persistent weak layer from early season. It's been active since December and caused most of the Christmas activity. While this persistent weak layer is trending towards dormancy, we've still seen a little bit of activity on it. As well, I mentioned those facets directly below the wind slab, so those fall into the persistent weak layer issue as well. We just want to pay attention to those coming into the next loading event this weekend. Overall, we've got a moderate danger on all aspects at upper elevations and a low danger at mid and low elevations. Remember that a generally low avalanche danger doesn't mean no avalanche danger, so continue to practice safe travel techniques and pay attention to changing conditions.
All right, Utah Avy's Nikki Champion, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Coming up later on the local news hour, I'll be speaking with Summit County Manager Shane Scott about tomorrow's county council meeting. Then KUER politics reporter Sage Miller joins the show to talk about week one of the Utah legislature's general session. Then we'll finish it up with Park City Library's Spanish services librarian Flor Santa Maria. She's got an update on Spanish language programs offered by the library. Park City's Main Street will fully reopen to vehicles today as crowds from the Sundance Film Festival dwindle. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
Main Street was closed to vehicle traffic over the weekend for the Sundance Film Festival. Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter designated the road as pedestrian only for public safety reasons after consulting with local, state, and federal law enforcement. The move came weeks after a suspected terrorist drove a truck into a crowd on Bourbon Street in New Orleans on New Year's Day, killing more than a dozen people. Park City Special Events Manager Chris Finney said the car-free Main Street concept was well-received.
Everyone, all the attendees, anyone I talked to on the street was just really happy to be able to walk up the street with all the activations and the lights and be able to take pictures in front of the Egyptian. It was really, really a positive feedback.
Despite the rave reviews, Park City plans to fully reopen Main Street to vehicles on Tuesday. Finney said restrictions on Swede Alley will also end Tuesday. However, Park Avenue will remain one way north or downhill until Sundance ends Sunday. Only city buses and residents with access passes will be able to travel Park Ave southbound or uphill. The airport-style drop-off area that was erected on Lower Main Street for the first weekend of the festival will also end Tuesday. Park City Transportation Director Tim Sanderson said free public transit remains the best way to get around for Sundance.
You know, I would just say if anybody's planning on going to any of the films, best way to get there is the bus. Even though the traffic's going to be considerably better for the next week, still, it's every time you take the bus, it's one less car off the road.
Buses will continue to run from the Richardson Flat Park and Ride near Highway 40 to the Old Town Transit Center every 10 minutes between 6:40 a.m. and 2 a.m. for the duration of Sundance. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And Governor Spencer Cox and other Utah elected officials welcomed the 2025 Sundance Film Festival Saturday. KPCW's Christine Weller reports they attended a screening of Train Dreams.
Cox, Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, other Utah leaders, and Sundance Film Institute leaders gathered Saturday for the first audience screening of Train Dreams. Cox said Utah's leaders always try to kick off Sundance.
It's a huge deal for our state. Over the past 15 years, economically, it's brought in about $1.3 billion in economic benefits to the state. But that's not why we love Sundance. We just love movies, and we love storytelling.
Cox has been vocal about Sundance's decision to solicit bids from other cities as the festival considers moving away from Utah in 2027. At his monthly news conference with reporters, the governor said he thought it would be a huge mistake for the festival to leave the state after more than 40 years. Organizers cited financial pressures and a lack of accessibility in Park City as reasons to move. In the fall, they said they had narrowed the list of interested cities to three finalists, a dual bid of Park City and Salt Lake City, Boulder, Colorado, and Cincinnati, Ohio. At the screening Saturday, Cox said he and other elected officials had been looking forward to viewing Train Dreams. The film follows the life of Robert Grainier, a day laborer building America's railroads at the start of the 20th century. He experiences profound love, shocking defeat, and a world transforming before his very eyes. Joel Edgerton, who plays Grainier, said the story is a study of a man's life.
Kind of speaks to all of us in all of our lives, in the sense that I feel like all of our lives are significant. We all contribute to the world that we live in some way, big or small, and we'll all probably be forgotten within a generation or two, but somehow our lives are also very important.
Train Dreams will make audiences laugh and cry as it explores the life of an ordinary man. Cox said the story reminded him of a quote from Middlemarch by George Eliot. He said the quote speaks to who we are and to the purpose of Sundance.
He wrote this: "The growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs."
Clint Bentley directed Train Dreams. His directorial debut, Jockey, premiered at the 2021 Sundance Film Festival and won a special jury prize for Best Actor. He also co-wrote Sing Sing, which has three Oscar nominations. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And joining me in the studio now, we've got Summit County Manager Shane Scott with a preview of tomorrow's Summit County Council meeting. Shane, good morning.
Good morning, Connor.
So last year, the county council decided it wants to create a housing authority. It looks like now it may finally do that. You're looking at bylaws tomorrow. So is this the beginning of the housing authority officially?
Yes, it is. And along the lines of this, as proposed by Jeff Jones, our housing director, this would dictate who makes those appointments. Who would be on that housing? I think he's calling that a commission. And it had one council member, I think one member from each of the three school districts, and one person that lived in affordable housing. And and I think that. The council can make these changes on the fly here in this meeting, but I think it's a good start. I think it's a good recommendation from Jeff. We also have an employee that he is trying to recruit right now, and that employee could serve as an executive director of this housing authority. So I think this is really coming together at a good time, and excited to see what the council thinks about this this ordinance.
Yeah, and before we dive into some of the governance structures that he's proposing, I think housing authority can sound like an inside baseball term to a lot of people. What would the Summit County Housing Authority do? And are there examples out there from other municipalities that you're looking at that you want to mimic?
Well, if you followed the process when we evaluated the housing authority in conjunction with Park City, we asked the housing director from Salt Lake City to come to one of our meetings. And he made a presentation about what housing authorities do. I think it could maybe take some of that housing pressure off of the council and make this more of an independent authority, an independent organization. There's tax credits and other advantages to a housing authority, but mostly I think this the council will probably retain a lot of that control of housing in our community, but the housing authority can also bring groups together. So this would be a way for example, Summit County to work with a Park City or with a Camas or with a Colville, and we can work together on one organization in meeting our housing needs in the county.
And it looks like to begin with, its jurisdiction will not go into the municipalities. That'll be sort of challenged by choice, I guess. Have you gotten interest from local politicians and municipalities yet?
We have. I wouldn't say interest in that we're going to start bringing those organizations in, but we have definitely had interest. We've made presentations to different municipalities in the county. I think it's a funding issue for most of those other organizations, but I think as we get up and running, as we get set, I think that we'll start to see some momentum. That's what we're trying to do. And if we do, we will certainly would love to bring on some partners if we can.
And you said the council would maintain control over a lot of housing. Do you mean, zoning control, land use control, or control over, just expand on that, I guess.
Well, I think it would be for certainly zoning control. But also, I think just on the decision making of where we have housing. If you followed our retreat, what we call our retreat last summer, fall, I think it was in October, we didn't go anywhere. But our retreat was really started out strong on housing. We really started to have some housing discussions. We have been looking at Park City as they've set a actual goal for housing, for affordable housing. Well, we've looked at that as an organization and wondered if we ought to do the same thing. We started that conversation through that retreat, and we are planning on having a more fleshed out conversation in March to also continue that and to decide what are our goals. Do we continue to believe that affordable housing is an asset as opposed to a liability in our community? And I think all of those decisions will still need to be made by our council. We won't be able to kick that kind of a discussion to a housing authority. At the same time, for me, it would be exciting to get this housing authority up and running, to get those commissioners established, and then to invite them to this housing discussion. So we do this collectively as a team.
Yeah, and you mentioned the 5-person board or up to a 7-person board. It would at least have one Summit County council member on there. I know some of the council members have differed in opinions on whether or not this should include electeds. Where has staff fallen on that? Why is this the recommendation?
I think we'd like to see one member of the council there. I think it just lends itself to some consistency. I think that the the housing authority has to reflect the vision of the council, or we're not going to get anything done. We're going to just propose things, and they're going to fall on deaf ears. So I think we need that consistency. I always like to have that liaison from a council member, whether that's on the Board of Health or this housing authority. I think that's a good practice.
And you mentioned you are hiring for the Economic Development Housing Manager, and the staff are going to offer that as the executive director position. Is that a new position in the 2025 budget, or is that an example of some of the turnover you've been seeing?
It is an example of the turnover. And of course, we lost someone we did value to Deer Valley, and that's okay. But I think that did lend itself to an opportunity to adjust a job description slightly and to bring this executive director of the housing authority into this position. So it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, and more job interviews on the agenda for the county council tomorrow. Last week it was Snyderville Planning Commission and Park City Fire. Tomorrow, North Summit Fire, and then Lake Rockport's Estates, kind of road services. Are you seeing lots of turnovers on these local boards, or is this more business as usual?
This is more business as usual. I think it's a 'tis the season. December 31st is many of our boards are, that's their expiration date. So for example, that North Summit Fire District, there's one person, there's one opening. We have six applicants. I think it's going to be easy to fill that with a valuable individual. I think there's three vacancies on the service area 5 that you mentioned for Lake Rockport Estates, and we have three applications. So that's exciting when we get as many interested in serving, especially those that are reapplying. I think two are reapplying from the service area 5. So I think it's business as usual. If you've been watching our council meetings since the 1st of January, you've seen a lot of interviews.
Yeah, and you have two public hearings tomorrow. The first of those is going to be on some code amendments that the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission positively recommended a while back. Those would require bike parking and EV chargers at new developments in the Snyderville Basin. As I'm reading this, one question that came up is, we're kind of built out in the Snyderville Basin, and this would apply to new developments. I mean, how much would this really change things and change the landscape of that area of the county?
Well, I wouldn't say we're built out. I would say that, you know, Dakota Pacific was a good example of that. If that's something that we would end up ever entitling further and going through a process, these codes would apply to them as well. So we'd like to see some of our sustainability goals hit in reference to development, whether that's electric vehicle charging stations or bike parking. I think there's a nod to solar in there. So we want to, and you know what, if none of these ever get used, I think we're still trying to reflect what the community in our rules and regulations. So I think there's still some development yet to happen in the basin, and hopefully they'll follow these regulations carefully.
I suppose redevelopments such as the one getting proposed by the Outlets Park City owner.
Absolutely.
Is there ever a scenario where you can bring current developments into compliance with the new code if they reapply for certain permits? How would that work?
I think that most of what is already developed would be grandfathered in without this requirements. We can certainly try to do that. When you ask that question, what I immediately thought of is some of our dark sky ordinances. So we put those into place. We didn't require folks to go back and do that until a certain time. And so that was an example of where we're actually just kind of ramping that effort up to further darken our skies here locally. But in this case, we wouldn't require folks to go in after the fact and put in electric vehicle charging stations. As you probably know, developers often will develop an housing development or a commercial development, and then they sell that off and move on, and that's hard to get back, and that's probably one of the criticisms of development in our community. But generally, we would encourage people to do these kinds of things, and usually we get a lot of positive feedback from the development community about some of our sustainability goals.
Sure, and it seemed to focus, as far as the residential side of this code amendment, on multifamily and maybe condos. Is there anything that single-family homeowners need to watch out for if they're thinking of building a home in the basin? Are they going to be required to have EV charging infrastructure or solar or anything like that?
No, as far as I know, what I read in the housing in the staff report, it was about multifamily and commercial mostly.
And the other public hearing being on what is apparently a growing in popularity, an Old Ranch Road farm stand, Copper Moose there. Apparently it's been getting so popular it's outgrown its permit. In what way has it outgrown its permit? Because the only change that I could tell in the code is that maybe it can operate in the winter by appointment only, and it would continue to be mostly a seasonal summer offering.
I think that's true. I think it's changing quite slowly. I think this is sort of a logistical situation where I think the use is granted temporarily, but it's done every season. And so it doesn't feel very temporary when it's happening every year. So I think we're trying to make a nod to that. And also, not only are we kind of maybe taking off the temporary tag, we're also, if you allow a conditional use in certain zones, you can also address issues that may come in with that use, parking, the hours of operation, how do people get in and out, and then there's also a certain events can take place there with food trucks and things like that. So I think they are ramping up a little bit, but I think it's just the logistics of going through a temporary permit every year we're trying to alleviate.
And before you go, I do want to touch on the ongoing signature gathering effort. Folks have filed for a referendum on the county council's vote in December to approve Dakota Pacific's relatively controversial Kimball Junction development there on the west side of 224. You did mention when the news broke about the referendum that, you know, the county wants to stay neutral, not interfere in the signature gathering process. You did subsequently put out that fiscal impact statement, putting kind of a dollar value on some of the community benefits that you see with the project. There was chatter in the community that seemed like a bit of a sales pitch. I mean, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that. Is that something that is interfering and in trying to sway voters one way or another?
Well, I'm not sure. But what I would say is, first of all, that impact, that financial analysis is required of the referendum process. So that's something we had to do. I actually believe that we didn't go far enough. I think the impacts will be greater than those that were outlined in that analysis. We talked about a lot of things to include that weren't maybe for sure going to impact us, so we left some of those out. But what's really important to me is that people sign that referendum or do not sign that referendum based on facts. As a county, as an organization, we are limited in what we can say. We can't tell people what to do, and we would never do that. But we can say what this might mean to our community. And so I've read some of the pros and cons on KPCW, for example, of those that have certain thoughts about it. I can also advocate for myself. If someone asks me personally on the street what I think, I'll certainly tell them what thing. I will never tell somebody what to do. But the analysis was a really important part of that, and I hope people read it. I hope people look at it and say, this is how this development being referred to the ballot and then subsequently overturned, this would affect our community in a financial way. And I think that's important for people to know.
And the fiscal impact statement, as you said, is required by state law to be put out before a referendum. It was framed a little bit as, you know, an estimate of losses. Isn't it more like, you know, what there is to be gained by allowing this to go through as approved in December, because none of it exists yet?
Yes, but I think that's the point of the analysis is, if this is referred and if it is overturned and if this development does not happen, what will the impacts be? So if you're saying what will be lost from today, you're right. There's not going to be much lost from today, but what is the potential of loss? I think that's still able to be included, and we've talked a lot about those community benefits that came along with the public-private partnership process, and I think that those are community benefits that our community will not realize if this is referred.
All right. Well, Summit County Manager Shane Scott, anything else that you want to mention today?
I don't think so.
All right,
Connor. Well, nice to be with you.
Yep. An investor in Vail Resorts says the company's recent performance has been unacceptable. It's calling on the ski resort conglomerate to make sweeping changes following the Park City Mountain Ski Patrol strike. Here's KPCW's Parker Malatesta.
On Monday, Late Apex Partners LLC, which holds shares in Vail Resorts, sent a letter to the company's board outlining several demands. The letter calls for the ouster of CEO Kirsten Lynch and CFO Angela Korch. It also says Vail should replace its board and its executive chairman, Rob Katz, should resign. Katz was Vail's longtime CEO who transformed the ski industry by introducing the Epic Pass and going on a wave of acquisitions, including Park City Mountain. The letter says the company must hire a proven CEO with a verifiable track record of leadership and innovation to reset the path forward. The financial firm's letter said Vail Resorts is fixable, but claims the board must act immediately to hold management accountable. The letter also claims that the core skiing community has labeled Vail the evil empire. It says the company's recent decisions have destroyed brand value. Late Apex also criticized the management of Vail's balance sheet and its capital allocation. It also says Vail should add resorts to the Epic Pass through partnerships. The move follows a 13-day strike by Park City Mountain ski patrollers during the holiday season. Skiers and riders upset about the on-mountain conditions during the strike have since filed a class action lawsuit. The lawsuit claims that less than 20% of the mountain was open during the strike, which left guests who spent thousands on holiday ski vacations in long lift lines waiting for up to 3 hours at times. Late Apex Partners said its stake in Vail Resorts is the firm's single largest position. In December, Vail Resorts reported that for the first time ever, it sold fewer Epic Passes than it did the year before. The company's stock was trading up 4% Monday. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Joining the program, KUER politics reporter and State Street podcast co-host Sage Miller. Good morning, Sage.
Hey, good morning.
All right. So it's been 1 week of the 2025 general session. How many bills have you been having to wade through? Are we on track for another record-breaking session?
I think it's too soon to tell. I mean, we're going to have thousands of bills by the end of the session. I will say, if you know anything about Utah politics and how the Utah legislature has acted the past few years, they've really come out of the gate running. And we're kind of seeing a little bit of a tone shift this session. A lot of the controversial bills, we didn't really know exactly what they were going to be heading in. Two of them have dropped, but they seem to have a little bit more of a slow burn. Slow burn being they waited until day three to introduce these bills, but I think that's different from previous years. And so a lot of the other controversial bills, we've heard from Senate majority leaders that they're still kind of being hammered out, so we haven't seen a lot of them. But we're still on track to have a fast-paced, rigorous 45 days.
All right, well, let's start with one of those controversial bills. It's HB 269. This would restrict which dorms transgender students can live in while they're in universities here in Utah. The way I read it, this seemed to be kind of motivated by an incident where there was a social media firestorm around an RA at USU in the women's dorm, transgender RA. What was sort of the context behind this bill?
Yeah, so as you said, it is restricting transgender students at public universities and colleges from living in certain dorms. So they would not be allowed to live in the dorm, in a sex-designated dorm that aligns with their gender identity. They'd have to live one that's that matches their sex assigned at birth, or they could live in essentially this neutral third option, which they would have to request and other students would. And under that option, a transgender woman, for example, could live with three biological females, and that would be perfectly fine, but they wouldn't be allowed to live in a sex designated dorm. And as you mentioned, the firestorm around this USU RA, the sponsor, Republican Representative Stephanie Grecius, who covers Utah County, she said this was not in response to the USU incident that played out. And I will say the student that raised the concern about living with a transgender RA was very swiftly placed into another dorm. So the university solved that problem on their own. But I did think it did bring attention. We had the Speaker of the House, Mike Schultz, take to Twitter and essentially say this is something that is not appropriate, will not happen, and we will hammer it out at the legislative session. And that came. However, Stephanie Grecius said there had been other incidents and that this is just codified testifying that this is not acceptable and that women should have private spaces, especially in college when they're at a vulnerable state, a state of mind when they're growing, maybe the first time away from home. And so she just said this was a way to protect the privacy of women, but it did not, again, stem directly out of the USU incident.
Okay. And you've been doing a lot of reporting on it this week, as you've put out there. It's the fourth year running that bills have taken up transgender rights.
Yes.
Is this just now a fixture of Utah politics? I don't know. What's your take on this 4 year in a row thing?
I will say the pattern shows that perhaps it is something they will continue to tweak and maybe perhaps find other avenues in order to address these kinds of issues. I will say with HB 2269, another provision is a kind of doesn't allow a lot of leeway or a lot of pathways for transgender people to use facilities, public facilities that aligned with their gender identity. In a previous bill last year that dealt with what we dubbed the bathroom bill, which was restricting which public bathrooms transgender people could use. There were some kind of outlines specifically for K-12 kids that perhaps they could use a note if they were on being provided any gender affirming care. That has been struck out of the bill. So now there is no kind of note you can get from a doctor or provider that says, hey, my gender identity aligns with this and I'm taking puberty blockers or hormone therapy in order to align that identity. So now there is no exception to the rule. As for a fixture in Utah politics, we have two other bills coming down the pipeline that deal with transgender issues. One deals with transgender and queer kids in foster care, and another one that has passed out of committee deals with where transgender inmates can live and what kind of health care they can receive inside of incarceration. So we will probably continue to see these bills, but those are the three that I'm focusing on during the legislative session this year.
Definitely. And worth noting that last year's so-called bathroom bill was introduced and passed by the District 4 House Representative Kara Berkland, whose district does include some of Summit County here. She resigned ahead of this session. But when I read that bill last year, it seemed like the first time that Utah lawmakers had entered the sort of category of man and woman into Utah law and tied that to the gender you're assigned at birth. And that's, I suppose, the gender forever. Has that made it easier for these bills that you said are coming down the pipeline? Are they building off of those categories from last year's bill?
I believe so. To put it point blank, I think a lot of the definitions, especially in HB 269, just hyperlink to the code that Berkland wrote. So I think it is, they have it enshrined in law. They have those definitions and they're continuing to use them in other legislation that is directed or focused on trans individuals.
All right. Well, maybe we'll jump to another controversial one. This has been making waves, HB 267. This covers labor unions in the public sector. It passed the House, I believe, yesterday or the day before. What have you heard from senators about this bill?
So I will say it was a very close debate, a very close vote in the House yesterday. So it passed 42 yeas, 32 nays, and 18 Republicans joined Democrats in voting against this bill. So there isn't a consensus among the caucus if this is going to be a shoo-in. I will say we haven't heard much from senators. Usually what they say is we need it in committee first, we need to look at the bill, and then you'll hear what we have to say during the floor debate. So they're focusing on their own stuff right now, but we know that it did pass out of the House and it's on the way to the Senate, assuming that it gets assigned to a committee, which it most likely will. And I will say this seems to be the bill that they are fast-tracking it's getting kind of positioned to pass within the first 2 weeks of the legislature. So as you said, this deals with unions, public sector unions, and it specifically kind of focuses on the Utah Education Association, which is the state's largest teachers union, the Salt Lake City Police, and Salt Lake City Fire. And that essentially, this bill says they cannot collective bargain. I want to mention that this most likely also impacts Park City school teachers who are unionized and also have the right to collective bargain. So that essentially just means they won't have a union rep sitting there advocating with leadership in schools or in police departments for better wages, for protected time, for retirement benefits, all those things that unions represent. So the Republican sponsor, Jordan Tusher of Salt Lake County, essentially just says taxpayers should not be paying money when teachers are collective bargaining. If they're going on strike, or if they're advocating, or if they're away from their desk while they're trying to negotiate with employee leaders over their wages or over their working conditions, and it really has caused a stir. People just genuinely really don't like this bill. They believe that it's taking away their voice. We've heard that a lot from the teachers union. And we also even heard from Doug Welton, who is the only representative, Doug Welton, who is a Republican and the only active public school teacher. He works in the Nebo School District, being essentially saying, I'm scared this is going to take away people's voice. While I do like some aspects of the bill, there's some glaring things that I can't look over. But then we also heard other people on the other side, like Republican representative Troy Shelley, essentially say unions and collective bargaining is a way for people to circumvent the legislature. And this is a way for them to step above us and not listen to us. And then we heard other people on the side of like, no, they should be able to talk. The legislature shouldn't be able to make all these decisions for them. So I'm assuming there's going to be some things that are going to be hammered out and changed in the legislation prior to it going to the Senate floor. And we even heard that from Tusher, that perhaps there's some changes that they could make in order to make the largest teachers union neutral on the bill instead of completely opposed. So
yeah, and one thing we saw with the recent ski patrol strike here in Park City is that you can file federal unfair labor practice charges if your employer refuses to engage in collective bargaining, or you know, if it's perceived that they're delaying it too much, stuff like that. If this bill straight up bans collective bargaining, how does that interact with the labor laws at a federal level? Is that at all part of this discussion?
I think I have two answers to that. I think the first one is I'd be curious to see the federal laws, how it is subjected to the public sector versus the private sector. I think those laws may be a little bit different. But then additionally, while they haven't come out and said this, if this does end up passing, I do foresee some kind of litigation in the future, whether that be from the teachers union, the police union, or the fire department, because all three of those sectors came out and spoke at committee against the bill. So I think people like their right to collective bargain. I think they like their right to unionize. And I will say that Representative Jordan Tusher said, this is not preventing people from joining unions. Those will continue. However, instead of having a union representative going and bargaining, or you know, making a list of demands, each individual employer within the union would need to go do that individually. So they'd have to do it themselves. They wouldn't have somebody advocating for them on their behalf.
All right, I want to ask about one bill that I've reported on because it seems to be of interest locally, garnered a lot of discussion at last week's county council meeting here locally. It's HB 37 housing amendments. This looks like it's adding an affordable housing tool, creating a density overlay where counties or cities could require developers to build up to 8 units per acre of deed-restricted affordable housing. But I wanted to ask, from your state reporter perspective, where does this stack up across other housing bills? Because I gather that statewide, the legislature is really focusing on for sale, stuff like that.
Yes, I will say this is probably going to be the largest housing bill coming out of the legislature this year. And something that we heard from Republican leadership and even Governor Spencer Cox is that housing is going to continue to be a big focus in Utah, as affordability completely outpaces wages and it's getting harder and harder in order to own a home. So this one is, I think, we haven't heard it in committee yet, and it's a very big bill. It's sponsored by Republican Representative Jim Dunnigan, and it's set to be in the House Political Subdivisions Committee, but we haven't heard it yet. And yes, I think that this is going to increase the amount of density and essentially maybe perhaps curtail a little bit of the drama that we've heard on the local government level of zoning. I think this is a big bill kind of dealing with zoning to try and say, hey, We need to pick it up here. We need to be able to have these conversations, and we need to build this housing, and we need people to kind of stop getting in the way of that. So I'd be curious to see how this goes down, but it does seem to have, on the housing aspect, a lot of support. I will say also on the housing front, there is another bill, and I feel like we see some version of this bill almost every year for the past 4 years or since I've been reporting in the legislature, but it is making it easier to build accessory dwelling units or a granny flat. And that's something that Republicans have been really on board with, and it's something that places like Salt Lake County, for example, has already done a lot of work on, but this bill would, the ADU bill, would try and make it so all cities can have ADUs.
Yeah, it seems like housing is one of those key pillars of the Utah dream that you covered this week in State Street.
Yes.
I just want to end on this one because that seems like their big main idea this year is Utah dream. And, you know, we're all familiar with the American dream. What, to their mind, is different about the Utah dream?
They want it to be a place of innovation in the place that Utah leads, where if you've heard a lot from Republican leaders is that they want to, you know, triple energy production in the state by 2050, which is a huge lofty goal. But they're saying like the Utah dream is being sustainable in ourselves and being able to export our goodies to the rest of the nation, or being able to own a home and grow a family and keep more money in your pocket instead of having them been withdrawn from taxes. So it's this idea that they want to just become a pillar of society and a place where everybody can look to as an example of what to do and not what to do. And so that's the Utah dream.
All right, KUER politics reporter Sage Miller, it won't be the last time to talk to you, but anything else you want to mention today?
No, I think we've covered it so far. So thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Here with me in the studio now, we've got the Park City Library's Spanish Services Librarian, Flor Santa Maria. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I gather you've got an update on Spanish language programs and services offered by the library. But maybe first, could you introduce yourself to listeners and, you know, tell us a little bit about what your position does?
Yeah, for sure. I came here, as many listeners, I'm assuming, have heard of our J1 students. So I did that for a little bit and just kind of fell in love with the town. Skiing, for sure. That's an easy one. But just the ease of, like, the small town life, it's pretty nice. And then my journey into the whole library situation was I needed a job. Mm-hmm. And the city was hiring. I had a friend working, and I was like, okay, you should apply for the library. It's a nice spot. She was right. It's a really nice spot to work in. The work environment is super welcoming and just everybody's so nice. And then the opportunity came up for me to apply for a full-time position as a Spanish services librarian, and here we are.
Yeah, you took over in November of last year. I can certainly relate to wanting to ski but needing a full-time job, unfortunately. So, you know, what are some of the services that you're rolling out this year, returning services? What is there for Spanish speakers at the library?
So for returning services, our story times are still going strong. For the past 6 months, I want to say, we started doing a Saturday story time. They're bilingual. Everybody's welcome is not necessarily just Spanish, but just the idea to make it more welcome into anybody that speaks Spanish, to have more opportunities to attend events and things. Upcoming events right now, I'm really excited about one called Chats in the Kitchen, or Charlas en la Cocina, that we're partnering with Latino Behavioral. And it's just a group that we're all going to get together and just kind of talk about mental health a little bit and learn how to cook traditional dishes and stuff from Latin America. Another one that's exciting is we have financial literacy classes, and as part of the series, the first one is preparing to pay for college, which is, it's going to be in Spanish. We have a whole series coming up in Spanish. There's that one, there's Investing 101, and just general, literacy, like financial literacy information. Clearly, I'm not the one giving the class, I'm just providing the program. Yeah, we're excited about preparing to pay for college. That's going to be on March 14th at 4 p.m. at the library. And all students approaching college are welcome to come with their parents or any responsible adults to learn more about different ways to save for college and stuff.
Yeah, do you offer information about upcoming programs online anywhere? If someone wants to share it with their friends, where do they go?
Indeed. On our website, under the tab events, you can just look up any kind of events, or you can go day by day and just see. We do our best to put all the information on the website. As for if the event's going to be held in Spanish or if it's going to be bilingual or what the event is going to be like. And you can also sign up for our newsletter in Spanish on our website as well. And you'll be getting a little email once a month, once every 2 weeks, just with all the information about the programs coming up.
Yeah, and, you know, this is kind of a wider cultural moment question.
Okay.
Because you definitely took this job, you know, with the new administration coming in, and there's going to be a change in policy regarding, you know, immigration and potentially a wave of deportations. You know, you're certainly embedded in the local Latino community here. And what do you hear from folks when they come visit the library about that issue?
In general, there's a lot of fear in the community. For what I've seen, not only at the library, just different community events that I've been able to attend. They did an event called Know Your Rights recently. That was a great way to get information out to the community and how to act if ICE agents come knocking on your door. Great resources are Know Your Rights. There's just a bunch of pages on Instagram that just say how to interact, to prepare you to, you can refuse a search, you can refuse, like, you don't have to tell anybody about your immigration status, and different tools to deal with these things. But yeah, mainly the community, I feel like, is afraid, and a lot of kids too. There's a lot of pressure on kids to be the responsible ones if anything happens to their parents. So we're trying our best to be a welcoming space and help out whenever we can.
Yeah, because you're a library and there's like a limit to what someone who trades in books can do. But, you know, you do have some resources that you're able to refer people to.
Exactly. Yeah, we have a community resources table where we have different tools and different community services that people can access. And we try our best to create programs and have space for the community needs, basically, and this is a big one right now.
How big is, you know, the collections section in Spanish at the Park City Library? I feel like I haven't, you know, passed Spanish books in the stacks when I walk around. Where are they?
Yeah, our Spanish section for adults is up on the second floor. It has a whole wall dedicated to it. We are expanding to a new section. As much as I can, I just try to, like, take more space. And it is a growing collection. We're trying to get new resources and stuff to be more inclusive, as for, you know, different ways of learning for everybody, or just tools that you don't necessarily have to read. There's audiobooks and stuff that we're trying to acquire next. And our whole kids section on the first floor, towards the back, we have about two shelves with Spanish and bilingual sections.
You know, we've seen in this state, you know, a wave of book bans.
Yes.
And those apply mostly to school libraries, not your library. When those bans are written into law, do they apply to the Spanish versions of those books if they're translated?
They can. I feel like it would take somebody really caring about the Spanish specific, being like, I don't want that book to be there in Spanish. But we haven't had that problem. We were just examining our new reconsideration policy for the library. And it's a whole step-by-step process. We haven't had anybody question books at our library per se. We even go as far as to do a banned books display every October and just all throughout the library. So we're pretty spoiled in Park City that we haven't had to deal with it. Thank goodness.
All right. Is there anything else you want to mention this morning, Flor?
Yes, we have a big event coming in May we're really excited about. It's part of an initiative that's been a long time in the making. We're opening our teleconsultation room at the library. We're hoping it'll be online around March for people to take doctor's appointments and stuff. And we're having a big health fair to do the grand opening. More details upcoming on our website.
Stay tuned. Okay. Well,
yep.
That's Flor Santa Maria, Park City Libraries, Spanish Services Librarian. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the Wasatch County School District's Board of Education will announce the mascot for the county's second high school at the school board meeting today. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has this report.
The district announced the name for the new school on social media earlier this month, Deer Creek High School. The school colors will be navy, silver, and white. It asked students, district staff, parents, and the public to cast their votes for the school's mascot with five options: the Broncos, the Diamondbacks, the Riverhawks, the Thunder, or the Yeti. It's been a long road to giving the new high school an identity. A year ago, a naming committee asked the district to move forward with Deer Creek High. In June 2024, the newly named principal for the school, Justin Kelly, pitched the Bolts for the mascot. The district hit pause just a few months later after community members protested those choices. But locals didn't like the next name choice, Iron Horse High School, either. Over 700 residents signed a petition asking the district to send out a new survey and stick with the winning option. Some said they were unhappy with how the decision was handled. The school district listened. When it published new surveys this month, it promised residents the top vote getters in the new survey would be the official decision for the new high school. Locals can hear the results of the latest surveys during the school board study session Tuesday at 5 p.m. More information about Tuesday's meeting and a link to attend online are available at kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.